All right, well, good morning. For you kids that are in the service, just a reminder, we do have our kids question as we do every week during the summer. We'll have that later this morning. And so you have a chance to win a prize. This time it's a plasma ball. And so we've got, we just had our illumination station VBS. So I think our prizes for a while are going to be things that light up in some way. Speaking of that, it's the 4th of July. Coming up here next weekend, and so hope you have a good time. Just a quick shameless plug. If you need help enhancing your festivities, some of the youth raising money for Costa Rica missions are running a fireworks stand just north of college through the 4th, or just north of town on college and Highway 1, and so you can stop by there anytime between 11 and 10. Through the 4th of July. It is it's the 250th anniversary or birthday of our country, 150th of our state, and so it's an exciting week coming up. I know a lot of people are out of town this weekend. I was kind of nervous coming into this Sunday because I talked to a lot of people. I knew a lot of people were going to be gone. I knew my family was going to be here, and Steve and Zeke, and I thought I might be talking about 7 people there. So thank you for joining me and give me somebody to talk to this morning. We are getting into a topic this morning that that is a significant one, even a weighty one. Okay, I think this morning we are going to be talking about some things that should leave a little bit of a weight on us. That's actually a good thing. That will be an appropriate thing for today. To wrestle through a little bit of some of those qualities of God that we don't like to talk about that much. And we're going to do that as we read about Noah and the flood from Genesis 6 through 9. Now, if you're new with us, we've been going through the early chapters of Genesis. We're in this series that we're calling Established. It's really a 3-part series, but we're starting trying to be established in creation, covering the first 11 chapters of the first book of the Bible, Genesis. And we believe that in these early chapters of the Bible, there are so many foundational ideas that we need to be established in. These ideas set the stage. Ideas about who God is, about who we are, about how the world works. Let me summarize some of those ideas that we've tried to glean from the first several chapters of the Bible. Number one, God was there in the beginning. That's how the Bible starts out. God was there first. And then number two, he created out of nothing. And those seem like pretty simple, obvious ideas, but those are fundamental and really, really important. And not every creation story has those. Sometimes chaos is there first, and then the gods kind of emerge out of that chaos, and then they go through this creative process in some way. But in Genesis, God was there in the beginning, and he created out of nothing. We also learn that loving relationship came first. Okay, that God is loving relationship within himself, in his triune nature, and that's really, really important. To start with love, love didn't come later. Number four, humans were created in the image of God. Of course, we're very different than God, but there is some continuity between us and God, and we reflect who he is in really important ways. We learn that male and female together reflect God's image. That God gave the human stewardship over the earth, and that humans disobeyed God, and that changed everything. Those are some of the things, among many things, that we've learned through the first 5 chapters of Genesis. And we're going to add some more this week and next week as we take 2 weeks to talk through Genesis 6 through 9, the story of Noah and the flood. And there's a lot to cover in these 4 chapters. We're not going to read every word. I'm going to summarize and paraphrase a lot, especially today. We'll dig into a few more of the details next week. But we are going to try to cover a lot. I want to give you a little bit of the game plan for this week and next. This is some of what we're going to cover this week. We're going to try to understand the nature of the human heart, That's what we're introduced to at the beginning of these chapters. Then we're going to try to summarize the flood narrative. We're just going to lay out the timeline and some of the details of this narrative. Number three, we're going to summarize the main positions on these chapters. I think it'll be good to provide a little framework and try to understand how Christians think about these chapters. We're going to have a discussion on our approach if we see things differently, if we have different positions on these chapters. I am going to give some theological or textual reasons this week for believing that a flood actually happened. And then we're going to understand the nature of God's justice, which is really the heaviness, the weightiness of this week. Next week, we're going to cover a few other things. We're going to dig into the details of the narrative more. And then, whereas this week we're just giving some really theological or textual reasons to believe in the flood, that a flood actually happened, next week it'll be more the historical scientific reasons. And we're going to consider the character of our covenant-making God, because these chapters close with covenant. God makes a covenant, and then we're going to focus on God's deliverance. And so this week, the focus will be more on his justice, even his judgment. Again, there's the weightiness there. But don't just come this week. You got to come next week, too, as we talk about his deliverance, how he saves, how he rescues from that judgment. Okay, so that's where we're going over these next 2 weeks. Like I said, we're covering these four chapters. You can go ahead and open up to Genesis chapter 6. It's on page 5, although, like I said, we're not going to read much of it. I'm going to read a few verses, and I'm going to summarize a whole bunch today, and then hopefully dig into some of the details more next week. But I would like to start with really where Travis left off last week. And I want to start by describing the state of the world during Noah's time, just prior to the flood, the state of humanity. And here's what we are told in several of these chapters at the beginning of chapter 6. It says this: "The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." And then in verse 11, "Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth." I think we need to consider those verses, consider this description. We're not given a lot of detail here, but we are given this. And it describes a state of the world that is pretty bleak. You know, often we read this story, we have these Sunday school images in our mind of Noah and his boat and the animals, but this is a pretty gritty story from beginning to end. And it starts here with this description of humanity. Again, we're not given a lot of detail, but we are told that humanity at this time was characterized by violence. Okay, the earth was filled with violence. So you can try to imagine what that would have been like. That the earth was filled with violence. That's how you could describe the world. I don't know if you've ever been in what you would consider a real violent place. I don't know that I have a lot. I've lived a fairly sheltered life, I think. Occasionally, I have found myself in a place that I knew was dangerous. Whether, you know, in some bad part of town, in some city, in different parts of the world, and I've just recognized, okay, there are some rough people here that know how to survive, and I got to watch myself. Maybe you've been in that kind of environment where you just recognize this is probably a pretty violent place. Well, take that experience and amplify it and spread it around the world, and this is what was going on at this time. It was an entire humanity that was characterized by violence. You can imagine the danger, the attack, the abuse, the rape, the murder, the rivalry, perhaps warfare. It was presumably a bloody, violent place. And that's what we're told about the pre-flood world. Now, the question we might next ask is, were they radically different than us? Okay, was this a unique time? Well, in some ways it was a unique time, but I don't think they represent a unique humanity. Okay, I think what we read here is the natural outflow of where the human heart goes apart from God's protective grace. This is just the road we barrel down naturally. Okay, that we all have seeds in our heart that will take us here collectively apart from God's interference, apart from grace that he pours out. There are those seeds in our hearts. I can consider that in my own heart. That when I really examine myself and I think about my own thoughts, I see the hatred and resentment and lust and envy and greed and all of those things that bubble up in me consistently. You know, in Romans 3, it describes the natural state of humanity by quoting some out of Psalm 14, but it says this: "What then? Are we Jews any better off? No, not at all, for we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside, together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one." Now this idea is presented in different places of the gospel and or in the Bible, and this is much of what can be offensive to us about what the Bible teaches. Because most of us have been trained throughout our lives to believe that we're basically good. We're basically good people. And yet we read this and it says no one is good. And the Bible tries to convince us that there are these intentions in our heart that are evil. And again, I see that in myself. I see those kinds of thoughts creep up in my mind. I recognize that even when I do good or even when I refrain from doing bad, it's not always because of noble intentions. If I refrain from doing bad, if I want to punch somebody in the face and I don't do it, it's not always just because of my nobility. Oftentimes it's because of my cowardice or my fear of consequence or fear of damaging my reputation. It's those kinds of things that often prevent me from doing bad. And then when I do good, so often I know there's this desire for self-promotion that is motivating a lot of that. And so even when I try to do good and even when I have somewhat noble intentions, there's always this selfishness that is woven in there. Okay, there's always those evil intentions that can often dominate my heart, even if I don't express that outwardly. I don't think they were just radically different than we are. They're just an example of where we all go unrestrained. Okay, every intention of our heart becomes evil continually. I think that's part of the message of the Bible. Now, at this time, when they had become completely corrupt, when they had become violent, of course God responds to that. God said to Noah, "I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth." This is what God determines to do. He sees all that violence. He sees all the corruption. And imagine that if he could see everything that was in every heart and he saw the abuse and the attack and the rape and the murder and all of that injustice, and there was something that welled up inside of him, and we're going to talk about this more at the end of this morning, something welled up inside of him. He said, I have to do something here. Okay, God's holy nature compelled him to judge. And so he does, and he determines to bring a flood to the earth. Okay, now we're going to come back to that a little later, like I said. But what I want to do now is take a step back and really just summarize the flood, summarize this whole narrative, and then talk about how we might view it a little bit. And then we'll come back to God's character behind this. Okay, so we're going to go through the timeline of the flood. Again, I'm really going to summarize these four chapters here with a few points. And as I do this, kids, you might want to pay attention. Remember, we have a kids question later. So there may be something in this summary timeline that you might want to remember. Okay, so first, Noah, who is called in the New Testament, he's called a herald of righteousness. Here in Genesis 6, he's called a righteous, blameless man, but he's called a herald of righteousness later on in the New Testament. Apparently, he spoke, he preached. Perhaps he tried to persuade people. He saw the corruption around him, and he said, come, turn. He tried to convince, and yet he could not persuade anybody. And so he... I'll try to speak loudly for now. So he tried to preach. He tried to preach, and they were not persuaded. But he was a herald of righteousness, and he heard from God and was told to build a huge vessel that would carry Noah's family and pairs of every sort of animal. Next, Noah built the ark over an unspecified amount of time, and then when he was 600 years old, he entered the ark. This is what it tells us. Number three, as he entered the ark, the fountains of the great deep and the windows of the heavens were opened. And so it wasn't just rainfall. There were these fountains of the deep that opened up from underneath somehow. Number four, the rain continued for 40 days and 40 nights, although the waters prevailed, is what it says, on the earth for 150 days. Until all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. And so the indication is that this prevailing, the floodwaters continue to rise and destroy for 150 days. Perhaps those fountains of the deep were still open. So it prevailed for 150 days. And as a result, everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died. After that, for the following 150 days, the waters receded until the highest mountaintops were visible, and the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. After a further wait and testing of the state of the world through the sending out of several birds, Noah and his fellow passengers disembarked after a little more than a year on the ark. And after that, chapter 9, God makes a covenant with Noah, which we will discuss more next week. Now, before we get into this more, we might just ask this simple question, did this really happen? Did this really happen? Did God really send a flood on the world? Because this seems pretty crazy. Okay, can we really believe this with confidence? Or is this just too outlandish? Okay, is it in some other category of believing, you know, you're believing in Bigfoot or a flat earth or whatever, something like that? Is it in that category? It's kind of fairy tale, or at least it's allegory. Did this really happen? Well, I think it did. And I think it's in a different category. It's a different category than trying to understand the shape of the earth, because that's something you can go out and test right now. Okay, you can in a variety of different ways. You can make observations right now. This is different. This is analyzing ancient history, and that's different. So it's just in a different category. But I think it did happen. But before explaining some of why I believe it did happen, I want to lay out various views or positions on this, on these early chapters. Really, it's Genesis 6, but really Genesis 1 through 11. And I think this will be helpful as we go along, just to frame things a little bit. and find ourselves where we are. And so I'm going to try to detail out the three main views or kind of categories of views related to the flood and Genesis 1 through 11. And I'm going to give this little table. And I want to talk about how each of these views sees these three episodes in Genesis. Genesis 1, Genesis 2 and 3, and Genesis 6 through 9. And so we have these three views. The first one, young earth creationism. The second, old earth creationism. And the third, evolutionary creationism, or also called theistic evolution. And I'm just going to describe these really quickly. So first, starting with young earth creationism, the view on Genesis 1 and the creation week is this, that it was six literal consecutive 24-hour days. That's how God made the world. It's just an actual week of time. How is it, how are Adam and Eve viewed? Well, they are viewed as historical people, the first humans, specially created by God out of the dust, and they are the ancestors of all humanity. And the flood is viewed as a literal, historical, global flood. Okay, so that's young earth creationism. Old earth creationism is different. First of all, Genesis 1, the days are seen typically as long ages or some other non-24-hour interpretation. Okay. So there was a lot of time in Genesis 1, most likely. But there is a bit of a break in between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. And so Adam and Eve are also seen as historical humans. Really, the first humans, also specially created by God. That may have happened in different ways. But there was a first couple that was created by God. And they are the ancestors of all humanity. As far as the flood, this position would view, they would see a literal flood, although probably a local or regional flood. Now, that a local flood doesn't mean small necessarily. It could have been all of Mesopotamia or even all the Mediterranean world, but still a local or regional flood. And then there's evolutionary creationism or theistic evolution. Genesis 1 would just be some sort of literary method or framework of some kind, but not really intended to be a literal chronology. Adam and Eve, there are various views there, but generally more archetypal or symbolic. They would be seen as kind of this maybe allegorical representation of humanity. And the flood sometimes may be seen as a regional flood, but often also allegorical. Okay, so these are the general viewpoints. There's also the intelligent design camp. That's a little different. And those that would be under that umbrella would promote design. A design that we see all around the world, but they wouldn't necessarily take a view on Genesis or the Bible kind of intentionally. And so there'd be not only Christians, but Muslims or those that believe that aliens designed and brought life to this world or something like that. But they're just going to promote design, but not really take a view on Genesis. Okay, so those are the three main camps in the church, how these early chapters are viewed. And I can be fully honest here, I'm in the first camp. Okay, I see a literal historical flood that happened. And I see Genesis 1 through 11 as history. And I'm going to explain a little bit of that as we go on. But before I do that, I want to ask this question: what if we disagree? Okay, what if we have different positions here? Because I know in this room there are actually good friends that I have that would see things differently than I do. Can we still be friends? Can we still have a partnership in this church in the gospel? Is that possible? I'm going to say yes. I think it is. I want to tell a little bit of a story that involves really the history of our church here. Many of you may not know. If you just started coming to this church in the last probably 10 or 15 years, you may not know as much there, but our founding pastor, his name was John Meyer, he was our first pastor, Summit View Church in 1989. John, he had a biology degree, and he was very, very involved in this topic of creation and science and geology and these early chapters of Genesis. He's very, very engaged there. And he taught very openly and clearly about these ideas. And many of us that have been around for a while were very much shaped by his teaching in this area. But John, I've also often heard John share a bit of an anecdote or experience. In the final years of his tenure here, he transitioned in about 2012-ish, he began to transition to more regional pastoral coaching. In the years leading up to that, he led much of our empty nester ministry. Okay, so he helped to lead those with kids out of the home or those that were a little older, and he led that ministry. But he co-led that ministry with a man who had a very much of an old earth perspective, who even wrote a book on it. And these two led this ministry together. And John will often kind of recount that. And so here's a man, a pastor, who brought his position very, very strongly and taught on it often. And yet he was able to lead this ministry with a man who had a very different perspective. And somehow they coexisted in that. And the question is that possible? I think it is. And I think I can sit down with friends across the table with a different perspective, and we can sharpen each other, and we can engage in this conversation, and it can be fruitful and productive, and it doesn't have to be heated. And we can push on each other. I think that's possible. So I want to say that to start off with. And yet, I still feel the freedom to bring my position. And so although I think there can be a lot of generosity and there can be that healthy dialogue, I don't think that means we don't talk about it. I think I can still bring my position. I can even try to persuade, and then I can be pushed back upon, and we can again have that dialogue. So I hope we can pursue that in this church. We can still be friends if we have a different position. But what I'm going to do now for the next few minutes is I want to talk about some reasons that I believe in a global flood. I believe that this really happened. And like I said earlier, today is going to be more the theological, the textual reasons, what we read in the Bible, what we know of God and ourselves, and why I think this is important. And next week, again, we're going to do more of the historical, even scientific ideas there. But I want to give you four reasons why I believe, for theological reasons, I believe in a global flood. And I believe in that due to the flood's implications regarding, number one, the character of God. Okay, I think there are strong implications here regarding who God is. And this would be one reason. When we consider the flood, when we consider our world, when we look around at our world, and we observe the different features in our world, we probably are either going to conclude that what we observe is the result of age, long periods of time, or catastrophe, flood. It's probably going to be one of those, one or the other. It's kind of hard to do both, actually. And so we're probably going to see things in through one of those lenses. If we do see long periods of time, we do see a process that was involved in those long periods of time. a process of development, even human development, that is in those features. But that process must have included a lot of death, a lot of brutality, a lot of disease and destruction. And that is a challenge for me to reconcile with the God that I see in the Bible. Okay, that's a challenge. And I think it's not only a challenge for me, I think it's even a challenge for skeptics considering the Christian faith. Trying to understand the Christian God, but also believing in those long processes. I want to demonstrate this by quoting a well-known skeptic named Alex O'Connor. Some of you might be familiar with him. He is I think he'd describe himself as an agnostic, but he's definitely challenged the Christian faith, although I think he does it reasonably well. He's not like the new atheists of 20 years ago. I would say he's more respectful, more thoughtful, more articulate, in my opinion. But he will push on the Christian faith. But he'll engage in, I would say, fruitful conversations with people. And I've listened, even just the last year, I've listened to a handful of things that he's shared, but specifically a couple of debates or conversations that he had with well-known Christian apologists, specifically a conversation he had with John Lennox, who's a mathematician and philosopher and an Oxford professor and a Christian apologist, and William Lane Craig, also a well-known Christian apologist. And both of those men, both of those apologists, John Lennox and William Lane Craig, have influenced me very positively. Okay, they've been actually pretty important in my Christian life, my belief. William Lane Craig helped me to just understand the reasons behind believing in a beginning of the universe. And he helped to clarify in my mind the moral argument for God and reasons to believe in an actual historical resurrection. He helped me see some of those things and was very strengthening for me in the early years of my Christian life. And John Lennox, likewise, has very winsomely and cogently persuaded and helped explain the Christian faith. And he has likewise been a valuable resource for me. I even recently read a book that he wrote on AI, even though he's 82 years old now. And he wrote this discussion of AI that was really, really helpful for me. And so these men have been meaningful to my Christian faith. And yet at the same time, they do have more of an old earth perspective. And each of them had these conversations or these debates with Alex O'Connor. And in each case, Alex brought up this topic of death and destruction being the mechanism that God used to bring about the current state of the world. So I'll just quote part of that from Alex. And so, of course, I don't think that the process of evolution disproves the existence of an immaterial mind behind the universe. But it does seem unlikely that if God's design was to bring about me and people like me so we could enter into a relationship with him, that he would choose to do so through a method which, historically speaking, relies upon the death and destruction of the unfit creatures, which brings up a problem of evil. And he goes on to elaborate on that. And he does that from different angles in these various conversations that he has. And to be honest, when I hear him engage with these apologists, and he starts to go down this road, I feel like in both of those cases, whether it was John Lennox or William Lane Craig, I felt like their response was lacking. Like it was just unsatisfying. It felt like they were on the ropes a little bit. And I think that's generally what I hear, where I experience when I hear this brought up. And so I believe that it is valid to question, does that long process of development that used death and the elimination of the unfit as a mechanism, how does that reflect upon the character of God? And we got to wrestle with that. Number two, due to its implications on the nature of the gospel, and this would be very similar, but again, that long process of death, does that affect how we see the gospel? Because the gospel is the message of Jesus Christ, and it's the solution to our sin problem, and it's the solution to our death problem. And the idea is that we earn death. The wages of sin is death. We earn death due to sin. And then Jesus dies for us to solve that death problem. But does it cloud things if death happened before sin? Does it cloud things? Now, I think it very much clouds things for the theistic evolutionist or the evolutionary creationist, because human death came before sin. For the old earth creationists, there's still animal death, at least, before sin. Does that cloud things too? In my opinion, it does. And I see the creation as very much intertwined with the stewards of creation, humankind. For example, Romans 8 says, "For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies." And it just seems like when you read passages like this, that the creation is groaning along with us, waiting eagerly for our redemption, so the creation may be redeemed as well. There's just this strong connection. And that's how I see it. And so I do believe that not believing in a global flood and instead believing in the alternative can confuse the gospel. Thirdly, due to its implications regarding the consistency of the Bible, and just as I read the Bible, it seems like throughout its pages, it refers back to these chapters as real history, real literal historical events. I'm going to give you a handful of examples. We'll start in the Old Testament. Isaiah 54:9. "This is like the days of Noah to me. As I swore that the waters of Noah should know," this is God talking, "should no more go over the earth, so I have sworn that I will not be angry with you and will not rebuke you." It just seems like he's referring to real history here. Ezekiel 14:14, "Even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver but their own lives by their righteousness, declares the Lord." Lord God. Okay, these were real men. Noah lumped into the same category as Daniel and Job. Psalm 104:5-9, "He set the earth on its foundations so that it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they may not again cover the earth." And again, it seems like it's referring to more than just allegory here, but actual history. We could go to the New Testament and the New Testament epistles, specifically the letters of Peter. Read one passage from 1 Peter and one from 2. "For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the Spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, because they formerly did not obey, when God's patience waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through water." Again, he's connecting it to something pretty important here. But he's saying this really happened, that there were eight people that were saved in the days of Noah. And then in 2 Peter, they will say, "Where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all things are continuing as they were from the beginning of creation. For they deliberately overlooked this fact, that the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water and through water by the word of God. And that by means of these, the world that then existed was deluged with water and perished. But by the same word, the heavens and earth that now exist are stored up for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and destruction of the ungodly." And also it seems like it is correlating two things that are very important: future judgment with the reality of this past judgment. And then similarly, we could go to the words of Jesus himself. And in Matthew 24, it says, "For as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark. And they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man." And again, this correlation between future expectation here, expectation of judgment and the return of Jesus, and the reality of the flood event. So I believe that seeing this as true history offers us a consistent hermeneutic or way to read the Bible. And then fourthly, and this is a little bit more of a subjective one, but just the nearness of God. And when I look around the world and I see flood, it makes God very real. I mean, to me, God becomes very, very real. And I see that not very long ago, he acted. He acted in a huge, severe way. And it just feels like God comes near. It's interesting that in the flood event, both God's transcendence and his immanence, a sense of those things grow in me. He's transcendent in that he's really big. He judges. He rules. He's powerful. But he's also immanent in that he's very, very involved in his creation. And he's concerned and he's grieved by the evil in his creation. And so it feels like the flood event helps to curb my deistic tendencies, the tendency to see God as uninvolved, and it just brings him very, very much into my world. So those are some of the reasons that I believe this actually happened. Now, I'm going to summarize some thoughts or return to what this narrative tells us about the character of God. But before we do that, I do want to get to our kids' question. Okay, so this is, again, for kids 7 through 12. And each week we ask a question. This is a little incentive to try to get you to pay attention. And again, we have the plasma ball ready for you here. And John is going to help me. He's going to bring a mic to you. I'll call on somebody, and then he's going to bring the mic to you. You can tell us all your name and your age, and then if you answer the question correctly, you'll win the prize. And so I'm going to click here and flash the question up on the screen and read it, and then the first person that I see, I'll try to point out.
Seven through 12. If you've already gotten it, don't put your hand
down. Yes, if you've already gotten one this summer, you got to keep your hand down. Okay, so here we go. For how many days did the water prevail on the earth? I think I saw Elias over here.
My name's Elias. I am 12 years old, and it was 40 days and 40 nights.
Actually, that's not what I'm looking for. That was how much it rained, and I'm asking about prevailing here. All right, why don't we go right here?
Timothy or Asa?
How about Asa there? I think I saw Asa first.
My name is Asa. I am 9 years old, and the answer, I think, is 150.
That's right. Yep.
Come on
out, buddy. Yep. All right. Okay. So prevailed for 150 days. It seemed to be still rising is what is implied by the text there. Okay, but let's kind of return to where we started. Remember, this whole series is about establishing ourselves in important truths that the early chapters of Genesis give us. And we're adding two to the list today. We're going to add another one next week. But the first one that we're adding is this one. I talked about some earlier. The human heart is inclined toward evil. Okay, the human heart is inclined toward evil, and this is offensive to us. Again, we tend to think that we're all good, but the Bible has a different message for us, that there's something in us that inclines itself towards self, even towards evil. Paul, again in Romans, describes his wrestling with this. He says, "For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is, in my flesh, for I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I keep on doing." And he knows what he should do, and yet there's something in him that just pulls him towards what he knows he shouldn't do. And he's describing a very, very human experience that we have all experienced as well. There is something in our flesh that draws us towards evil. It inclines us there. And that's something that we need to recognize. We don't just overlook. We have to recognize that there is something there. There's something in me that keeps pulling me in that direction. And even in the good that I do or the bad that I refrain from doing, there still can be these selfish motivations in me. And so that's hard for us to really embrace, but it actually gets harder. Because the other truth that we want to add to our list this morning is that God pours out his wrath on evil. Okay, our hearts are inclined toward evil, and then God pours out his wrath on evil. You know, the book of Romans is really this long 16-chapter summary of what we call the gospel, the good news, the message of Jesus Christ that explains the way of salvation and God's grace, and it is heavy on the grace of God. But also, the book of Romans uses the word wrath 10 times to describe God, far more than any other New Testament book. For example, "But because of your hard and impenitent heart," and he's describing people that are really just hypocritical. They're judging people for doing the same things that they do. "Because of your hard and impenitent heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself on the day of wrath when God's righteous judgment will be revealed." And this is again a challenge for us, but something that we cannot gloss over. Of course, we want to talk about God's grace and his acceptance, his affirmation of who we are. And yet, we've got to let ourselves settle here first. Okay, we've got to make sure that we see God as wrathful. Again, that's a difficult truth. That's not one that we like to bring up, but we must, because that's part of who God is, and we can't just truncate God. We've got to take the whole of who God is, and he is wrathful. He's severe. He judges. He's holy. He's just. And when he sees all the evil in this world, again, he sees the rape and the murder and the abuse and all the injustice. And remember, when we see those things, there's something that's stirred in us. When we see some sort of horrible abuse and injustice, there's something that wells up in us, and we demand justice. That must be paid for. Okay, we've all experienced that. That has to be paid for. That's wrong. How much more so with a holy God when he sees all of it? He sees all of that abuse all around the world. all those intentions of the heart that are inclined towards evil, and he sees the outworking of them and how awful they are. Those seeds that are in each one of our hearts, he sees the full expression of them. He sees that, and appropriately so, there is wrath that is stirred in him. He must crush that evil. And I think we need to make sure that we speak that message here, because that's part of the message of the Bible. And that we can't, it's unloving to allow all of us to just go through our lives unaware or ignoring that reality. It's like going back to the passage I shared earlier from Jesus in Matthew 24, where he describes it this way: as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark. And they were unaware till the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. And so we can be similarly unaware, just going through our lives, doing our normal things, unaware that God's wrath is waiting to be poured out. And again, we have to settle there. We have to receive that. We have to just immerse ourselves in that truth some. But once we do, then it causes us to cry out to God, to cry out for mercy. And that mercy is available. And that's where we're going to go next week. Okay, we're going to talk more about his deliverance, his ability to rescue, his ability to save from that wrath that we all deserve. And so we have to keep going, come back next week, and complete this story that God is a Savior. But we are going to touch on that this week, and we're going to touch on it through communion. And we are going to share communion this morning. And Steve and Zeke, you can go ahead and come on back up. Because this is where we recognize or we remember that Jesus took wrath for us. Okay, we need to remember that all the time. Jesus took the wrath that we deserve. Okay, he was judged in our place. Okay, a holy, righteous, just God must punish all the evil in us. But a loving, gracious God offered himself to be punished in our place, to receive the consequences that we owed. Paul says this: "For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way also he took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes.'" And what we're doing here, when we eat the bread and drink from the cup, we are simply remembered, Jesus was broken for me. God's wrath, there was a flood of God's wrath that was to wash over me, and Jesus got in the way. He stood between me and my deserved punishment, and he took it. And so we're going to remember that right now. Again, we just use this experience to recall to mind that God offered that gift to us, to take the judgment that we deserved, that was owed to us, himself. And so what we're going to do is, again, we split the room down the middle, and we exit to the outsides of the room, and then we come back and we come to the tables and we take the elements. You can take it back to your seat. The smaller plates are gluten-free if you need those. And you can come back and then have a moment with God there. Okay, remembering his willingness to break himself for us so that we did not have to be broken. Have that moment. Remember, reflect, and then we're going to stand together and sing. about his steadfast love. So those in the front, you can begin to come down. Also, one more thing to share. Sorry. This, of course, is a bit of a ceremony for those who have received this gift, who would say, yes, I believe, I'm a Christian. For those who haven't yet, we would invite you to refrain from this, but to consider it, to consider, is there a penalty that I owe? And is God prompting me to surrender to him and let him pay that penalty for me? At least consider that as we go through this. But now go ahead. First row, you can come on down and take the elements and return to your seats, and then we'll sing together.